Hi, this is Barry Listed Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science and Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. When we hear a major business leader like Rupert Murdoch appear before Parliament and declare that this is the humblest day of his life, those of us who lack his business success may derive some satisfaction in a bold businessman who finds his humility. But is there a benefit in having CEOs who leave their fear at the door? Would we even have a company like Apple if they didn't have a business leader with an ego the size of Steve Jobs? In today's segment, we talk to Dr. Alberto Galasso of the University of Toronto and Dr. Timothy Simcoe of Boston University. They're the authors of CEO Overconfidence and Innovation, which appears in the current issue of the Informs Journal of Management Science. Professor Galasso, welcome to the Science of Better.
Hi, Bertie. Thanks for having us.
And Professor Simcoe, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
The business press often dwells on CEOs and their success, but it's one thing to be a reporter writing about a company and another to be a scientist who designs a study with academic rigor. How did you come to begin this line of research?
So, Tim and I have been working on innovation for several years. We both think that innovation is the most important engine of economic growth. And we thought it was very important to understand what drives corporate innovation. And if you look at previous research in management or economics, you see that scholars have tried to understand the determinant of corporate innovation looking at tangible things like R&D expenditure, number of employees, cash flow, sales. So what Tim and I did was to start thinking about how is that the beliefs of top management may affect innovation. So we ask the question, if we look at the psychology of CEOs, can we improve our understanding of corporate innovation?
And it's interesting that you look at both hard business facts and psychology, which is a little bit similar to the kind of things that are happening in behavioral economics. What's the main point of your study, would you say?
Well,
the main conclusion, I guess, I mean to
right.
ask.
We found that CEO beliefs can actually affect corporate performance through innovation. And specifically, we find that companies run by overconfident CEOs are associated with roughly a 20% innovation premium. So this company invests more in R&D, obtain more patents, and obtain also better patents per R&D dollars than company managed by non-overconfident CEOs.
So we're talking about significant findings.
Right.
In literature, we associate overconfidence with the classic Greek idea of hubris, which brings down a hero. And indeed, there's some research pointing to overconfident CEOs who try to merge companies like AOL and Time Warner to disastrous results. Why did you believe this wasn't the whole story?
I guess we thought that if it were the whole story, then those kinds of CEOs would get weeded out and replaced by market forces. I mean, if all overconfident CEOs ended up being total catastrophes, there wouldn't be too many left. And the flip side of that is if overconfidence generated huge benefits, all CEOs would be dramatically, you know, sort of more overconfident than the rest of us. And maybe they are a bit on average. But our point was that for there to be a mix of overconfident and less overconfident CEOs, there had to be both costs and benefits associated with overconfidence.
I would assume that also applies in the political world, and sometimes we look at scandals and we wonder how could that politician ever have made that mistake, but if someone is timid, they're not going to be successful, and sometimes that lack of timidity leads into other areas.
Yeah, and I guess our thinking as two people who have been working on innovation for some time was that that seemed like a natural candidate for an area where overconfidence might be beneficial.
People tend to form their own personal opinions about whether a person is confident or even overconfident. When you're conducting a study, of course, you need to construct a metric for something like overconfidence, which seems like a very difficult thing to do. What metric, what form of measurement did you choose to use?
Well, we used a measure that was first developed by two economists named Ulrika Malmander and Jeffrey Tate, which is based on how CEOs do or don't exercise their executive stock options. I mean, the place to start in thinking about this is that you need a definition of what is overconfidence.
Right, and which seems very hard to do in a clinical way. But in any event, please continue.
So the way that psychologists have thought about this is that someone is overconfident if they have excessively optimistic beliefs about their own abilities. So they think they can control events that are really primarily random, or they believe that their performance is going to be better than it is in spite of a great deal of evidence to the contrary. One way to think about it is to link it to these Lake Wobegon ideas that, we all believe that we're above average. To figure out whether a CEO has excessively optimistic beliefs, Malmander and Tate's insight was we can look at whether they sell what are called fully vested, highly in-the-money executive stock options. And what that means...
Yeah, I was going to say that this is a little bit of a sophisticated financial term, but please explain.
What that means is that CEOs are often compensated by giving, by the board of directors will give them the right to purchase stock in their own company at a pre-specified price. But those rights don't become exercisable for a number of years. So the measure of overconfidence that we use looks at CEOs who, 4 years after they were given these rights, the stock price in their company has increased by 66% at least. So at that point, they have the ability to do what's called exercise their stock options and buy stock in their own company at a price that's 66% less than it's currently worth. So they can turn around and sell that immediately and make a large profit. And the question is, do they do that or not? A CEO who...
Do they buy and then immediately sell for profit?
That's right. Almost no one actually buys the stock and holds it because it would be cheaper to simply hold on to those options, and there are tax implications to actually exercising the options because you convert them to stock.
Uh-huh.
So the behavior that we see in the world is always either hold the options, which is essentially taking a bet that the stock price of your company is going to go up, even though it's already gone up by 66% or more over the last 4 years, or cash out now by exercising your options and then selling the stock. And so the CEOs who choose to hold on to those options, even though they own the right to turn them into cash and the stock has gone up dramatically over the last few years, are essentially making a very large bet on the positive future stock performance of their firm. And we consider that as sort of a measure of their revealed beliefs about their future performance.
Let me remind our listeners that this is a Science of Better with Barry List of Informs. Our guests today are Timothy Koh and Alberto Galasso, who are discussing their study, CEO Overconfidence and Innovation, which appears in the current issue of the Informs Journal Management Science. What happens to a CEO? He's confident, he's overconfident. What happens if he gets still more power, if, say, that he becomes president or chairman as well as CEO?
So what we find is that if the CEO is even more powerful, the effect was stronger, in the sense that those CEOs have even more power to affect the innovation of their company.
Right. So we found a positive relationship between our measure of overconfidence and the firm's ability to get more patents and to translate their R&D spending into patents. And we found that that relationship is stronger for CEOs who seem able to exercise more control because they also have board seats or presidency of the firm.
And we'll talk about patents in a moment. How does competition affect innovation among these overconfident CEOs?
Right. So we found that the premium in innovation generated by overconfidence was greater in more competitive industries. And the idea behind this finding is that innovation is something risky, and is especially risky in industry that, like airlines, that are very competitive and where margins are very low. On the other hand, if you are a successful innovator, you can impress the market and increase the value of your company. And you can impress it a lot if you are competing with a lot of people that try to come up with the additional innovation. So this is why the effect of overconfidence is stronger when there is competition, because competition amplifies the benefit of innovation, essentially.
So in a sense, these are CEOs who not only enjoy a good fight, but are looking to advance their career and see that they can do it through competition.
Right.
You might say that the clincher to your research is that the CEOs you flag not only increase the number of their company's patents, but also take their companies in a new direction. What have you concluded in terms of strategy coming out of overconfident CEOs?
I guess our conclusion takes us back to where we started, which is that, you know, so overconfidence is something that comes with costs and benefits. Not every time does it succeed, but when it succeeds, we think it is because these CEOs find new directions to take their firms in, and that's, you know, what you might expect from someone who's overconfident. So we talk about a few examples in the paper. One we used was Lou Gerstner, who, you know, sort of is famous for turning around IBM, and we discuss a variety of ways that he actually reorganized and refocused the research that goes on inside IBM in ways that were consistent with sort of shifting the company's strategy from selling hardware and software to becoming a global computer services firm. Or another one we talked about who actually showed up as overconfident in our data is Andy Grove of Intel. And they sort of famously got Intel out of memory chips and into microprocessors. And so those, we think that the kinds of innovation effects we measure are very consistent with large shifts in strategic direction. And that's what's kind of the underlying force that we're identifying.
And those two examples have been very enduring. Those two companies still remain very strong. And what happens to a CEO as he or she grows older or just stays at their position for a long time? Do they stay innovative?
In our data, we looked at overconfidence in a couple of different ways. You know, so we thought about the question of, is overconfidence something that is a permanent trait associated with an individual? So if they ever are overconfident by our stock option-based measure, they're always overconfident. Or is it something that comes and goes? And we found evidence consistent with a link between overconfidence and innovation under both kinds of measurement strategy. But, you know, your question about as they, you know, sort of CEOs who remain for a long time, it seems to me that in the data at least, sort of you have a limited window of opportunity to be a CEO. And most of the large kinds of corporate firms that we studied, you don't get to become a CEO until your late 40s or early 50s, and most are retired by the time they're 65.
Uh-huh. And I guess I'm wondering, does somebody put their all into something right at the start and then become conservative farther into their tenure?
So we don't find any strong effect in that direction, probably because the time window is not long enough, you know, in order to really, you know, innovation takes a long time, and so in order, you know, the time window is not large enough to really see changes, dramatic changes in effort for these CEOs.
Let me remind our listeners that this is The Science of Better with Barry List of Informs. Our guests today are Timothy Koh and Alberto Galasso. To conduct your study, you had to pick good measures of innovation, and let's look at a couple of those measures. For one, what industries did you decide to study and why? You mentioned airlines a little bit earlier.
Right. So we wanted to have some broad funding, so we didn't want to focus on any specific industry. So what we did, we looked at essentially all the industry where innovation plays a key role. So we didn't look at sectors like finance, insurance, and real estate, where patenting is not very common, but we consider all the other industries like pharmaceutical, electronics, chemical, manufacturing, where patents can be important and are frequent mechanisms.
And to some extent, this is the ability to measure. So you might have somebody who's innovative in terms of creating credit default swaps or financial vehicles, but this is a much more difficult thing to measure in the finance industry, for example.
Right.
What data did you pick in the industries that you considered? What data did you pick to tip off innovation and success?
Right. So what we do, we look at large companies that most of our analysis focuses on the period between 1980 and 1995, because for this company, previous literature has showed this negative effect of overconfidence that you were referring about. So we wanted to use exactly the same data to show this positive effect through innovation. But we also show that we have similar figure if we look at more recent data, like a period from 95 to 2005. On the other hand, you know, with older data, you can do a better job because really to measure innovation and to distinguish between successful and non-successful innovation is better to use not data that are too recent.
So you can compare two different time periods and allow a gap between them for for a kind of longitudinal study.
Exactly.
That's right.
You can also identify what kind of innovation develop, and you see for what kind of innovation you see the company building additional technology over it, so patenting and citing this patent, and what kind of innovation instead are more likely to die.
Professor Simcoe, were you going to add something to that?
No, I mean, I think that Alberto hit most of the points. We needed to work on large public firms because we require this information on stock option holdings, which is only available for public company CEOs. And then for those firms, we're able to gather information on innovation based on their data on their R&D investments and on their patent holdings.
It might seem obvious, but why are patents an important measure of innovation? Are they just a slam dunk, obvious measure?
Well, they're widely used, and there's been a lot of prior research that links the patents, and in particular patents weighted by the number of citations those patents receive, to the actual stock market value of the firm. So we know that patents are valuable. Maybe that is obvious, but it's been well documented in a lot of studies.
What do you mean by citation? Do you mean when a patent officer is looking at a new patent and reviewing earlier patents?
Yes, so either the patent officer or a lot of the time it's also the applicant for the patent is required to cite other patents that have relevant prior art, which means that the number of citations that a patent receives is a measure of new technology building on it or trying to invent around it. And so those citations are a way of trying to understand the value of a particular patent. The more sites it gets, the more relevant it is to future research and patenting and innovation.
Uh-huh. Taking a step back, in terms of the way you reach your conclusions, is it possible that innovative companies just tend to pick overconfident CEOs?
So, yeah, we were worried about that, and we tried to do some careful analysis and tried to see whether the arrival of an overconfident CEO was somehow related to some innovation activity that was happening before the arrival of the overconfident CEOs. And our data seemed not to show that. The innovation takes place after the overconfident CEO takes place. The rise in innovation takes place after and not. There is not big difference in the activity before the CEO arrives.
I guess looking at the conclusions reached, one from a business standpoint comes to kind of an obvious question. Did these overconfident CEOs actually make money for their companies?
I mean, I think the answer is some did and some didn't. On average, the stock price of a firm managed by an overconfident CEO didn't go up any more than it did for a non-overconfident CEO. In fact, we can't tell the difference in what happened to the stock prices statistically,
uh-huh.
even though the overconfident CEOs arguably behaved in a riskier way. On the other hand, our findings suggest that the firms managed by overconfident CEOs were more successful as innovators. And so you put our result next to the earlier results by Malmandir and Tate that says, well, these overconfident CEOs are destroying value, shareholder value in some ways, like doing too many mergers and acquisitions or being excessively willing to invest the company's free cash flows. And, you know, you sort of get this broad lesson that we started with, which is that you have to take the good with the bad, right? These overconfident CEOs are probably good at innovation and bad in other ways. And so it's a question of matching the right manager to the right company at the right time if your objective is to make money for their companies.
We only have time for one or two more questions. You mentioned a couple examples of classic CEOs, Lou Gerstner and Andy Grove, as examples of what you report in your study. Are there any CEOs who are very active today that you might also draw attention to?
Maybe we can look, you know, if our measure pick up these people that are portrayed by the press as overconfidence, but to really see the impact of that is just not possible if we just look at data that are too recent. You know, you don't know if the innovation that is going to be developed this year or in the past couple of years is going to be a very successful innovation if you don't have enough time data to see what's going to happen with that innovation.
Yeah, I think there's an interesting point in what Alberto was saying, which is that when you use these measures of innovation based on R&D and patenting, there's often a substantial time lag between those events and when that shows up as value for shareholders of the firm, you know, both in terms of how long it takes for the idea to diffuse and get put into practice, how long it takes for the patent to issue, how long it takes the firm to build a business model around the underlying technology.
We live in a time of great technological growth. Does your research lead you to make any observations about CEO overconfidence and innovation today?
One thing that has been documented a lot by economists is that if we look at the total amount of R&D taking place by companies in developed economies, this amount of R&D tend to be smaller than what would be the social optimal level. This is why you have government intervention for subsidies in R&D or really grants for R&D and things like this. Now, the fact that overconfident CEOs invest more in R&D and innovate more can tell you that at least in that dimension, from a social perspective, a bit of overconfidence can be good because it increased the amount of research that has been done in the economy.
Final question, what research are you gentlemen working on now, and what will we read about the two of you in the future?
We're thinking about what to do next in this area. So we haven't started it, but Alberto and I have talked a little bit about maybe using the recent financial downturn as another way to try and understand how different kinds of CEOs behave with respect to innovation in different kinds of business environments. So maybe there's an opportunity there to look at whether CEOs who are overconfident or have different kinds of backgrounds and experiences were more likely to sustain their innovation investments through the financial crisis.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Dr. Alberto Galasso of the University of Toronto and Dr. Timothy Koh of Boston University. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening to the Science of Better podcast by Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. For more about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.